So I will call this talk on Parshat Tazria Mitzora, Illness and Anxiety, Two Prescriptions. So months ago, I found myself struggling with the teaching from a Zen sutra that I heard from Norman Fisher. His words seemed to offer an important path to becoming less anxious about all the things that go wrong with our human bodies. After all, we are such a health-conscious society, it's hard to talk to anyone without hearing about something they're doing that seems to be very healthy, and we haven't done it, and now it's already too late for it to make any difference for us. Or else, despite their best efforts to live a healthy life and follow all the instructions, someone dear to us is suffering terribly with illness or injury. So I knew there was something very important in this Zen teaching, except I totally could not understand it at all. And Norman said, the reason we get so worked up about illness is that we take it personally. Well, of course, we take it personally. Isn't this me, my body? What's the alternative? But he was explaining that through our practice, we can transform the way we identify with this human body. That if we don't see this body as who I am, as the self, then we could be less anxious. So this is the same message that's in Thich Nhat Hanh's metaphor for enlightenment. Enlightenment is when the wave realizes it is the ocean. Or as Norman explains, today's experience of the human body is an occasion, just like a wave arising in the ocean is an occasion, not an enduring entity. We can enjoy or even take delight in this occasion. However, if we think we can hold on to this particular waveform without it dissolving back into the ocean, we're going to get upset each time some part wears out or gets broken. And this is all part of the general Zen project of the deconstruction of the self, of course. It's one manifestation of it. Well, when I first heard this teaching, it was completely incomprehensible to me, as it may be to you. However, somehow I knew that this teaching still pointed towards some powerful relief from the anxiety that I so often feel about illness. So I knew I had to be patient and wait for some experience that would help me understand it. And since this writing these talks is the time that I focus most on trying to understand one of these principles with the help of a Jewish perspective, I decided some months ago, when I became confused by this, that I would find a way to give a talk about it here so I could reflect on it from another perspective that might shed light on it. However, every assignment that I got for teaching here, going by the calendar, didn't seem to me to have any clear enough connection to this particular topic until a few weeks ago, when we were working out the teaching schedule. And when we came to the date today for the Torah reading Shabbat Tazria Mitzora, that one, of course, is famously unpopular, and no one ever wants to teach it because, as you may recall, it's filled with repetitive descriptions of skin lesions, mold, and other signs of decay, and repetitive instructions for what the priests were supposed to do to decide when suffering people needed to be isolated from the community and when houses needed to be torn down because they could not be purged of their decay. And at that moment, I realized this would be the perfect Torah reading to help me struggle with the Zen question. I thought if I could reflect together on these two impossible texts that seem to revolve around the same thing, disease and decay, I might be able to see the teaching in a way that would illuminate the issue. So first, let's turn to Parsha Tazria. Now, the most important thing to remember in reading these verses is that they give the appearance of being about medical or hygienic or public health practices, but they do not have any basis or rational relationship to medical diagnosis, treatment, or hygiene. The words impure and pure, which are often used to translate the Hebrew words tameh and tahor, are simply the words of the priest's classification system. The priests have to decide if something is tameh or tahor, and tameh, as Reb Moshe often reminds us, means not ready to join in the temple service, and tahor means ready and able to join in community observance. So this makes a great deal of sense when we read the passages that begin this Torah reading about women not attending the ritual offerings of the temple when they have just given birth. The postpartum period is a time for recovery, for focus on the caring of a new life, for being cared for by others. It's not a great time for attending a ritual sacrifice. And certainly, there is no implication here that tameh means that the mother has done something wrong by having a baby, because that's what women were actually supposed to do. Similarly, we are commanded to take care of the dead, to treat them with respect and dignity, to wash them, to stay close to them, and to bury them properly. Yet, according to these rules, anyone who has touched a dead body is tameh and cannot serve in the temple until there has been a ritual purification. When it comes to skin lesions, there is, as I mentioned, an appearance of public health concerns about the spread of disease, but the rituals do not address diagnosis or sanitation in any consistent way. And then there are the laws concerning reproductive fluids, and then there are signs of decay in textiles and construction materials for building, in buildings. A theme that runs through all these different states called tameh seems to be contact or connection with that transitional and tender space between life and death. The uncertainty about the vulnerable state of the newborn and the mother, any signs of illness, decay, or death that frighten us, birth and death, in other words, and anything that might give rise to anxiety and uncertainty about life or permanence in the material world. Or we could say anything that makes us aware of our impermanence, whether it's decay of the body or the homes we live in. As humans, we have this wonderful capacity to think ahead and realize that we will all die. This uncertainty of mortality seems to be the driving force for religious practice. All religions deal with the uncertainty and fear that surround death. And that is related to our awareness that everything in this material world, as the Buddha says, arises and passes, is impermanent, and that the only refuge from that impermanence is a concept that is immaterial, some concept of an enduring process that we call Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. So in Tazria Mitzora, the answer to any of these anxiety-provoking reminders of our impermanence is pretty much the same. The answer is, we've got a ritual for that. As with any rituals, most rituals, the point seems to be, if you are suffering, you do not have to deal with it alone. You will be visited by a priest who will assess the situation and prescribe a ritual, something that you or the community can do about this. The rituals that are prescribed in this Torah reading make no sense to us at all. However, the rituals of healing, of being cared for, of having someone who cares about you trying to figure out what's going on, who can tell you that there's something you can do about it, this interpersonal, relational approach to treating human conditions is very powerful. Whether in medicine, psychiatric treatment, or any alternative healing practice, or traditional healing practice, the placebo effect of the rituals of care is very powerful. It usually depends on having a trusting relationship with the caregiver. In a study of the response to patients for treatment of depression, the initial and most widely read about study showed that a particular medication was effective as an antidepressant, which usually happens in 60 to 70% of the people who take it, not in everybody. But that it was better than not having the medication, or in general, better than the placebo. But then the researchers reanalyzed the data, looking at which patients saw which prescribers, not just who got the medication, who got the placebo, but who was prescribing the medication or the placebo to the patient. The researchers then ranked, there were nine different prescribers in this particular study. They ranked the nine prescribers according to their track record, right? So they found the top three prescribers who got the best outcomes regardless of what they were using. And then they looked at the bottom three who got the worst outcomes regardless of what they were using. And guess what? They found that the patients who saw the most effective prescribers had better outcomes according to the symptom self-report scale that they did. Those patients had better outcomes with placebo. That means one of the, quote, good prescribers giving the placebo than the patients who saw the least effective prescribers and were receiving the real medication, the real antidepressant. In other words, the relationship with the prescriber seemed to make a huge difference in whether a pill would help, whether it was the active pill or the placebo pill. Okay, back to the Torah. So if you're brave enough to read this parsha, you'll see that some of the prescribed rituals actually cause the individual pain and suffering. For example, the person judged to be tamei has to dress in rags and cannot speak except to utter the words tamei, tamei as a warning to others. However, there was a shared belief that this protected the community and kept the community safe from becoming tamei. Here we give a hint of connection. Here we have a hint of connection with the Buddhist focus on it's not about you, it's about all of us. Torah teaches that individual freedom has to be limited for the well-being of the community. So the approach preserving the communities, this approach really focused on the importance of preserving the community's connection with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh by keeping the ritual practices aligned with the instructions that were said to have been received from God. These are instructions, needless to say, that have been interpreted and implemented in other ways by the rabbinic tradition. We have to remember that we are reading this parsha immediately after last week's reading about the temple's opening day, when Aaron did everything just right and God responded by showing God's glory through a spontaneous fire that was alighted on the altar. It was an affirmation that the system set up by the instructions God gave to Moses and Moses gave to the priests, that the system was working. And then Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu, as we discussed last week, did their own ritual that was outside of the box, not exactly what was instructed, and were consumed by the fire. So not doing things just right, especially in participating in the service, appeared to bring disaster. So the Torah's response to this punishment, Torah's response was a punishment for what has been seen as too much spontaneity, perhaps, or maybe not a punishment, but a response to this spontaneity. As we said, it could have been a positive thing that they were immediately reconnected with the universe, with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. But the Torah's response is that this disaster is followed by a string of very detailed rules about kashrut. And then after that parsha, in the ones we read this week, we read about childbearing and reproductive fluids, skin lesions, nocturnal emissions, mold in houses, all anxiety-provoking reminders of the thin veil between new life and death. And we read about the practices that are believed to keep the community aligned with God's intention and to keep the channels of connection to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh open. Now, the Buddhist prescription for addressing anxiety caused by illness shares a focus on something. It's not just about you, it's greater than the individual, but it's a more radical treatment that goes right to the source of the anxiety, which is our delusion of having a separate, solid self with enduring traits. There are a number of metaphors to point in the direction of understanding, such as the one we mentioned, enlightenment is when a wave realizes it is the ocean. The goal of practice is to be relieved of this burden of carrying around, supporting, feeding, and maintaining our sense of self as something. We may feel ourselves weary of sustaining this burden. It sometimes occurs to us, how much time have I spent worrying about what people thought about me because of what I said, the way I look, how I talk? How much time have I spent worrying about what other people, what my job, my work, my lifestyle looks like to other people, lifestyle looks like to other people? When really, it's my actions, how I treat others, what I actually do in my relationships, that's what's critical. Right action, right moral views, being kind and caring are paramount. In the Zen traditions, every time you sit at a group meditation, you begin with, I know I am of the nature to grow old, to be sick, to die, to lose everyone that I love, and yet My deeds are my only possessions. The most important thing is to focus on understanding what in this moment would skillful action be, without getting derailed about what people think of you. It's not about how does myself look to you. Relieved of the delusion of self and attuned to the interconnectedness of all things, we may see our illness and suffering from a different perspective. Humans and illness, buildings and mold are all processes that interact in a constant flow. Sometimes these events occur within our particular body envelope, sometimes in others. And modern medical practices and public health measures allow us to intentionally protect ourselves and others from many things, and yet we can't control everything. Illness, aging, and death are the most obvious ways that we are reminded of our impermanence. If we accepted impermanence as natural, impersonal, not a punishment, could we be less anxious about illness? Whether through ritual, as in the Torah reading for this week, or through modern medicine, humans have the wonderful capacity to strive to decrease suffering. And we have, over the millennia, discovered many things that work, everything from ritual healing practices to bone marrow transplants and beyond. Yet the ability to control some things can lead us to strive to control everything, to buy into the delusion that if we do the right things, we can avoid illness, aging, and death. Illness can feel like a sign we failed to keep ourselves healthy, or a punishment for not doing things right. But if we commit to this practice of discovering whether we can stop taking it personally, would we find some relief from the anxiety, from the inner narrative that torments us with what if, why me, what should I have done, why did I do that? Could we experience greater freedom to enjoy the occasion of being alive in this present moment?